Monday morning. Hope your day is off to a great start so far. It is coming up to 10:06. Hi, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. It is time this hour for Science Files. It's our weekly look at news from the world of science. And Dr. Rob Thacker is back with us this morning, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11, it's your turn to sound off this morning. We'll go to the phones next hour for Manic Monday. It's our first open hour of the week, and of course, as always, anything goes. Activists on the South Shore are raising the alarm about clear-cut harvests in Nova Scotia's forests, and they're calling for an immediate moratorium on clear-cuts in Shelburne County. We'll hear more coming up after the news at noon, and we'll hear another Halifax History Moment this afternoon when Halifax historian and author Blair B. joins me. It is now 10:06, but at this hour, it is time for Science Files. And joining me this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I could be better. I've got the allergy that's going around. Yeah. I think it's a very mild flu virus. So I'm going to go home after this and not infect people at work.
There you go.
So I'm just going to infect you.
Well, that's fine. I've already gone through this. I had one day with chills, and the next day it was the sweats. And then the next day I was better.
That's actually pretty close to what I've had. So I woke up in a pool of sweat on Saturday night after spending the day in bed, basically. And yesterday I was feeling a bit better, but again, woke up this morning and gosh, I sound so weird on the headphones. It's like, that's not me.
Okay. Well, not to distress you, but it lingers for a while.
I have to do a trip in a couple of weeks, so I hope it's gone
by then. Should be gone by then. Yeah. We hope anyway. All right, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a comment or a question for Dr. Rob here this morning, that's why he's here, to try to answer your question.
So be nice.
He's not feeling that great, folks. The SpaceX Dragon capsule returns to Earth. It detached, I guess, from the International Space Station on Friday. And what's the significance of this, Dr. Rob?
So the significance of this at the end of the day is really the U.S. having a vehicle for getting astronauts back up to the International Space Station. Literally having a rocket and a crew vehicle to actually get astronauts in space. They haven't been able to do this since the retirement of the shuttles in 2011. So this is a big, big, big deal. This technology, I do want to say, I mean, we've been doing this for a long, long time. This is, I can't say this is not rocket science, because it is. But anyway, getting this to actually work isn't something that we haven't done before. It is. So nonetheless, SpaceX doing the commercial design, manufacturing, and then flying this mission for the first time is really a big step forward for commercial space flight in the US and for the US in terms of its capability. So this is a really big deal to see that now we have a situation where there is a tested crew capsule for SpaceX. Now, the big thing is everyone's wondering, when are they going to test it? So with people on it. And so that's aimed for the summer. But they apparently have to test the emergency system before they do that. So they have to do a launch where they literally fake an emergency, apparently. Okay. So that will happen fairly soon. And then once that is done, I believe, then they will have the first crew test. Assuming everything goes okay. They have a slightly different way of doing the emergency. They have rockets on the side that actually just blast off the top of the rocket. Apollo was kind of similar, but they had rockets that jetted off a stack that was above the crew capsule. Hmm.
This is a pilotless spacecraft, right? There's nobody flying this.
Well, to a large extent, most of rocketry is computer controlled now anyway. So for this particular launch, absolutely.
But it's not like the shuttle.
Even with the shuttle, a lot of that, it's automatic, right? So, but when you have people on it, are they going to be doing, they're going to be monitoring. Yes, there will be docking things that people can do by hand, but most of the stuff that you're seeing when a rocket launches off, it's all under computer control.
And this obviously is, again, the commercialization, I guess, of the space program, right?
That is the big thing I'm trying to bring up. Yeah. So, I mean, this is, the key thing is, like, as I always point out, I mean, private companies were building things for NASA. They were contractors to NASA. But NASA was the one who was supplying the engineers, doing the design and so on. And now we have a situation where all of that design is being done in-house. The great advantage, to be honest, of SpaceX over NASA is that they can build all of their supply chains and control all of their supply chains and not have to do what is called pork barrel politics,
yeah.
where when you have a very, very expensive political development, you have to farm it out to different places. And inevitably, that introduces problems with geography and other things. Whereas SpaceX has been able to streamline all of that process and become more efficient because of that. And you're seeing, I think, probably suggestions that they are benefiting from that model.
Now, Virgin Airlines isn't interested in doing deliveries to the space station. It's looking at commercial tourism, right?
Yeah. So Virgin Galactic will be suborbital. So that will literally be space tourism, getting up a few seconds of weightlessness just as you go up, then you come back down.
Yeah.
And so that is a very sort of quick trip. This, on the other hand, getting up into orbit, you're going significantly faster, getting up to, 28,000 kilometers an hour. So that is a real heck of a ride. And so the other thing that I should point out is landing boosters that are for orbital injection is considerably harder than just landing a booster that goes up suborbital and comes down again. So this is a big step forward. And I mean, SpaceX, to give kudos to them, landing the boosters from orbital rockets, everyone was questioning whether you can do that. And now they do it routinely. They don't miss the barge. Well, they miss the barge every now and again, but it's really, really impressive.
So what's their main competition? Who's their main competition?
Oh, so on this, it would be Boeing.
Boeing, okay.
Yeah,
really?
So Boeing has something called the CST-100 crew vehicle. And so that Boeing also has a number of different launch vehicles, most of which are fairly old, actually, to be honest. But technology works. Keep on using it. I mean, Soyuz is old as well. I mean, the Russians keep on using that. So Boeing will be testing their vehicle this summer as well. I think Boeing got the more expensive contract of the two of them for the development.
Hmm.
So we'll see how that does. But... No, it's big news for SpaceX, and I think, excuse me, I'm dying already.
That's all right.
As I said, I think the really big thing for SpaceX is what's going to happen once they are flying people, because it's one thing to fly unmanned vehicles and have a pretty good success rate on that. It's another thing altogether to have an accident when you have astronauts involved.
Truly.
So
yeah.
They haven't gone through that as a company, and we will inevitably... That's going to happen sooner or later, right? All of this talk about the big BFR rocket carrying many, many, many people. Imagine something like that happens. Now,
yeah.
Of course, you can say with Boeing, 737 MAX 8s,
yeah.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. That's a really big question mark over them. And I believe Air Canada's got a few of
these
as well.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
So, okay, it's happened before, and big companies know how to deal with these, what kind of research they have to do to improve safety. But nonetheless, SpaceX hasn't gone through this as a company yet, so it's going to be, I don't want to say interesting. We would all hope that would never happen, but I think it's inevitable it will, and to see how they respond to that.
Indeed. 10:14 is our time. We're going to take a break here in a moment. Still with space travel, by the way.
Yeah.
I was looking at a promo for a new movie. It's a documentary coming up on the Apollo 11 mission.
Oh, yes.
Looks fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. No, this is, I had no idea there was all of this hidden footage.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, no, I really want to see this. And supposedly it's done in cinema verite style.
Yeah, something like that.
No commentary on
no
it.
No commentary,
It's literally just footage of the moon from 70 mil. I didn't even know they did 70 mil.
It's found in a storage bin somewhere in a NASA office space.
Yeah.
And
So that's really amazing. And completely different, of course, to the First Man movie, which is a true kind of movie. This is more kind of like documentary,
I
guess.
Yeah, that should be fascinating. I'm not sure when it's out. I'll see if I can find that information out. But it looks absolutely great. 10:14 is our time. Paul, stay there. You're coming up. Alfredo just called in as well. We've got lines open, too, if you've got a question this morning. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back to hear more from Dr. Rob right after this quick break. Coming up to 10:17 here on a Monday morning, Dr. Rob Thacker is with us. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University, and this is Science Files. And Paul has given us a call this morning with a question. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
You have a question?
Is there anybody at the university that knows all about meteorites?
Actually, the person who probably knows most about meteorites is probably in the geology department. I know Dr. Jacob Hanley is very interested in meteorites and has a collection, I believe.
Yeah, I got a funny-looking rock.
Oh, you found something you think might be a meteorite?
Send it to the geology department. That would be the thing to do.
Yeah, it's magnetic, and it's a little smaller than a baseball.
Okay.
But it weighs like 2.5 pounds.
Sounds like there's a lot of nickel in there or something.
Pardon?
Sounds like maybe it's got a fair amount of iron or nickel.
Yeah. Yeah. And it has lines like where it burnt, like what I think they call them thumbprints.
Okay. And where did you find this, Paul?
In a thrift store.
did you ever
hear the story about the meteorite that fell on that young woman's car in Pickskill, New York?
I can't say that I have.
Well, yeah, it's in a book at the library here. Anyway, it was her first car, you know, as she bought what she could afford. And a couple of nights later, she was parked in her driveway. She heard a great big bang. And there, the back of her car was all wrecked. And it was a meteorite that hit it. They got a sign in the back window that this car was hit by a meteorite. And she sold her meteorite for $90,000.
Yeah, so you're kind of hoping you can cash in. Is that the case here?
Found it in a thrift store.
I don't know. But I'm just saying, there are people that collect meteorites, and they pay big dollars for them.
Yeah. But to suggest that the meteorite ended up in a thrift store, that might be a stretch, Paul.
Well, I don't know.
Well, you never know what you're doing.
Maude Lewis' painting ended up in a thrift store sold for $25,000.
Yeah.
$1,000 at auction, and the woman paid $3 for it.
Well, Dr. Rob is suggesting that you send it to the geology department.
They'll know, yep.
At the St. Mary's?
At St. Mary's Geology, yep. Dr. Jacob Hanley, yep.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let us know how you made out, Paul.
Yeah, okay.
All right, appreciate it. Bye. That would be interesting. Find a meteorite in a thrift store?
Yeah, no, the honest answer is you get a lot of people saying, oh, I found a rock. Is it a meteorite? Yeah. And so, but in this particular case, people will be able to make some kind of ascertain whether it is an iron nickel meteorite or not.
But they are worth a great deal of money.
They can be. The main thing for them to be worth money is to have this story behind them. And so, for example, the Pescil meteorite is a very famous story. In fact, I've used that in teaching Astronomy 101. There's a very famous picture of the hole that it made and so on. And so we talk about it. So it's not surprising that sold for $90,000 because it's a bit of folk history kind of there. So,
but I'm not sure, you know, found it in a thrift store is a good
selling
point.
Yeah, that's not quite going to be the same. And the funny thing is there actually are a lot of meteorites out there. So I visit a colleague at Arizona State University quite often, and their school of, space exploration and so on, they have a whole collection of meteorites there. It's several hundred of them.
All right. Alfredo's on the line with a question for us this morning. Hi, Alfredo.
Hello. Are you?
I'm well, sir. How are you doing?
Could be better.
I'm doing fine. Thank you. Dr. Robert, what time is in the station there in the space station?
That's a good question.
What time is there since the time change here? You know, do they have a savings time or do they use California time or what?
Dr. Rob, how can you answer that question? What time are they on up in space?
What time is in this space station for the people who they leave there?
We got that, Alfredo. Hang on, let him answer.
So I think they use UTC on the space station, but because there's no easy light and day, it almost doesn't matter what they use up there. So you're going around every 90 minutes and so on. So really, it really doesn't matter what time zone you use. You're going to be adjusted to whatever you want.
So if he's looking at his watch up there, they're probably on their Florida time.
No, I think they will be on UTC if I remember correctly.
What is UTC?
It's Universal Coordinated Time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's not like Greenwich Mean Time.
It's equivalent to GMT. Oh, okay. Yep.
All right. So there's your question.
They don't use the time from California, like Cano Canaveral or Los Angeles?
Not as far as I'm aware, no.
Or the people who they are from other countries, they don't use the country time?
He said they use basically the equivalent of Greenwich Mean Time, which is the central time that goes through England that sets the hours of the time for the rest of the world.
Oh, okay, I got it now.
So there you go.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Alfredo. Appreciate the call. Let's see here. Mark emails in regards to the sun. He says, I understand that the sun runs off of hydrogen. It'll run out in 5 billion years or so. Since this is nuclear fusion, what keeps the sun stable during this fusion reaction? Is it a balancing act fusion versus gravity, he is wondering.
Absolutely. You've got it just bang on. So it really is a balancing act of the energy coming out of the fusion versus all of that mass that's pulling the sun back down together. And so over time, as you use different atoms and you fuse different atoms, the size of the star will change. So as the sun is used up most of its hydrogen and goes on to helium, then it will actually swell up into a different kind of object because of the different balance of the energy release.
Interesting.
Yep.
You're looking at a story there that I mentioned this morning, and that is the lack of sunspot activity on the sun last month has some speculating that it's goes back to a period of time back in the 1600s to 1700s.
The more the minimum, yep.
Yeah, where the little ice age, as they're referring it to, and some are speculating that the lack of sunspot activity in the last month might be a precursor, I guess, of another little ice age.
Yeah, so this is interesting. The thing to remember was that even during the morning minimum, the temperature change that we're talking about is only about a tenth of a degree.
Really?
Right. It's really quite small. And so there have been a number of papers looking at climate models that actually obviously account for the change of the variability of the sun. And you can basically break down the impact of the variability of the sun on top of the increase of the CO2. And so if you just sort of like plot the two, what you see is the increase in temperature from the increase in the carbon dioxide keeps on kind of going up, and the change in temperature from the sun changing is kind of like an oscillation going up and down. But you put the two together and you see this small oscillation on top of this thing that keeps on going up.
Okay.
So at the end of the day, the sun, yes, it does have an impact on the climate. There's no denying that. But it's not as strong as the increase in the CO2 that we're actually doing as humans. So if we're looking at a tenth of a degree change, that's pretty different to the 1.5C change that we're all worried about as part of the IPCC reports.
So we don't have to worry that we're in for another ice age of any sort.
Well, there could be some kind of localized impact of that. But at the end of the day, the other thing to remember with the Maunder Minimum is that there was a lot of volcanic activity around that time. And it's not completely clear that there wasn't an issue with aerosols and so on in the atmosphere creating a different kind of like a what you might consider equivalent to the nuclear winter scenario as well.
Okay. 1025. Jim, good morning to you.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Jim. You have a question for Dr. Rob this morning.
Yeah. How come all the planets, you know, Mars, Jupiter, and those, you can see them, but there's no light. You know, they don't produce light.
Okay, no, that's a reasonable question. So you're right, they don't produce their own light. They do produce their own heat, though. That's an important thing to remember.
I don't get this. You see Mars up in the sky, looks like a light.
It's reflecting.
Oh, okay.
Right, so that's what you're seeing. It's reflected light. So the only, I mean, it depends upon, again, what particular wavelength of light, because light isn't just light. Oh, I sound so scientific. Okay, so the electromagnetic radiation from gamma rays at one end all the way down to radio waves, light is the same kind of thing. And so you have
Well, when you look at Jupiter, it looks white to me, you know.
Yeah, so that is reflecting light from the sun, right?
Okay.
And it's reflecting it back to us.
So it's like acting a mirror kind of thing.
Well, yeah, it's literally as soon as you light anything up, like you light a table up with a flashlight, you see it because that's reflected light.
Okay.
So
the planets way out there, like the Pluto Tower or whatever, they're reflecting the light from our sun?
You got it.
Yep.
Absolutely. You got it.
Simple answer. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Have a good day.
Thanks, Jim. So if we were on, let's say, Neptune looking at Earth, would we see a reflection from the sun then too?
I mean, it would probably be quite difficult to see the Earth from all the way out there because you'll see phases and so on, because all of the things we see with the moon having phases, if you're outside, you'll see the same kind of thing. We get that with Venus as well. We see phases of Venus.
All right. I'll let you have a little break here.
Yeah, I need a break. Rest
your voice. Get some water, and we'll tell you it's coming up to 10:28. We're going to break here in a moment for a news update and then more with Dr. Rob. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also send us a question via email. My email address, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a question, our Twitter handle at The Rick Howe Show. But right now we're going to break for a news update and then more with Dr. Robin Science Files. We'll be back right after the news. Coming up now to 10:33 here. It's a Monday morning, and Science Files underway here till 11 with Dr. Rob Thacker. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University, and he's here to answer your questions. And if you've got one for us, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255, or send us a question via email, rick.howe@news957.com. Just reading a story here that's a headline, Robo-Journalism Gains Traction in Shifting Media Landscape. And it says a text-generating bot nicknamed Toby produced nearly 40,000 news stories about the results of the November 2018 elections in Switzerland for a media giant in just 5 minutes. Yeah. These kinds of artificial intelligence programs are becoming more widespread as news organizations turn to them to produce stories, personalized news delivery, and in some cases, sift through data to find important news. Dr. Rob, my job is going to be replaced by a bot?
Well, it's eventually, but not quite yet. So this has been something that's been on the radar of journalists for some time. And there are a lot of stories out there that are kind of, for want of a better term, formulaic. You have a specific thing you want to get out. And everyone knows. I mean, this has been done with sports score reporting for a number of years as well. So it's kind of disconcerting, though, because you wonder what might they miss, right? So when you have a real journalist working on these things, then if there's something unusual, then they're going to know. They'll have context, whereas an AI system that's just reviewing things doesn't have that context. So they are not equivalent systems, but they are doing a job that, you know, was kind of like the grunt end of journalism, I suppose you could say.
So, well, it says here, the news organizations say the bots are not intended to displace human reporters or editors, but rather to help free them from monotonous tasks like sports results and earnings reports.
Yes, an earnings report. So, I mean, I know that, Bloomberg has been doing this for a number of years as well. So, yes, I get that. But at the same time, it's kind of, I don't know. I think the really interesting thing is what happens if they try and give these particular programs personalities.
And you say they're working on this. Are they trying?
Well, it's always something that they kind of think about doing. I mean, most of the stuff with AI, particularly speech and so on, is focused on the particular dialect and so on. But, I mean, you could imagine giving things personalities and what that would do, pick different types of people. But that's probably a ways down the line.
Yeah. But I have at home one of those little Google things. Hey, Google.
Yep.
And it's got a bit of a personality.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's inevitable that we will project as well. Because, I always find it funny how now, I mean, I have a new Google phone, and I was just talking the other day, and I happened to have it on, and then someone said something, and then it alerted because it just interpreted a sound. So, so that kind of makes you think, oh, it's a little bit inquisitive about the conversation. So anyway.
We've asked Google to tell us a joke, and she'll tell a joke and give a little tee even. So that's just kind of neat anyway. Here's an interesting story. Bacteria that eat pollution and emit electricity were captured in hot springs for the very first time. Scientists, it says here, trekked into the depths of Yellowstone National Park in the States to extract these bacteria, which are adapted to living in geysers and hot springs that can reach over 90 degrees Celsius. These tiny creatures can eat pollution and generate electricity in the process. This sounds like one of these eureka moments.
So what exactly are what's the pollution they're eating? I mean, that's the million-dollar question there.
Let's see here. It says, publishing the findings in the Journal of Power Sources, the scientists admitted that these so-called electrogenic microbes were targeted due to their ability to produce power, which experts hope could be harnessed in the future to drive devices. The team struck electrodes into the water for hot springs and left them for a month to be colonized by the bacteria. Some of these electricity-producing bacteria have the power to convert toxic pollutants into less harmful substances.
Okay, well that's completely reasonable. I mean, so the concept of having things that eat something that we consider toxic and turn it into something less toxic is something that we've been working on a lot. I mean, for example, plastics and using similar to not actually silkworms, if I remember correctly, but there was some kind of grub that would eat certain types of plastics and then sort of break those down as well. They had enzymes to break those plastics down because they're literally like really sort of really dense waxes in some cases. So that kind of thing is something that we do and we're interested in already. Whereas the converting to electricity bit, my head goes to how do you harness that?
Yeah, it says here, right? Scientists hope that the microbes can one day power all kinds of systems. They have been limited by the handful of varieties, though, that they've been given to grow in labs.
Yeah.
But by employing the naturally occurring populations in places like Yellowstone, they hope they can develop something that helps to both produce electricity and clear up pollutants.
I mean, it sounds interesting, but
yeah.
Not sure how practical that's going to be. But, you know, I mean, given a little bit of development, who knows?
Who knows? 10:38 is the time with Dr. Rob Thacker here on this again, Monday morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Craig emails a question, says, what do you suspect the next ice age will be? Also let him know that his golf swing is looking good. Saw him at an indoor range a few weeks ago.
Oh.
Mm. Yeah, hey, practicing a little getting out in the links, waiting for spring to come by.
Yeah, no, I'm actually a bit of an avid golfer, and so my dad, as you probably remember, passed away.
Yeah.
And so my dad sort of said, look, you never played up to your potential and you should do that. So I'm kind of on a quest to honor my dad's memory on this. So, yeah, I'm practicing quite a lot. I'm trying to play around to scratch.
Oh, really? Now, what's your best score ever?
76.
Oh, my. That's pretty darn good. You
could
be almost on the
tour. I played
a
lot when I was a kid, and I was pretty serious. I mean, it's interesting how different golf is in North America compared to the UK, because, like, in the UK, everyone plays golf.
Really?
Like, I would be out there, I'd be playing with kids who, like, dads with a bricky or whatever. And it was a little bit expensive, but it wasn't crazy expensive. And then you come over here, and it's kind of like this elite sport over
it
here.
Is, which, yeah.
I mean, okay, there are public clubs, but a lot of it is sort of like more expensive and so on. So it's a bit different in the UK. So a lot more people play, and it's kind of an every person sport to a large extent there. And so coming over here, it's been interesting to see how it's different. So yeah, I've played a lot, and I'm working with the coach to try and improve and so on. So
good,
yeah,
good
kind
stuff.
Of serious.
My best score ever, 110. And
okay.
That was on a good day with the wind blowing just
the
right way.
On the first nine, right?
Yeah, something like that.
No,
I am not.
Had a good joke with my friend Jerry. He said, if you shoot 83, we'll let you play the next nine.
All right, what about his question here? He says, when do you suspect the next ice age will be? I guess, let me just qualify that question. Will there be a next ice age?
Well, there could be. There could be if we have a situation where we have enough particulate put into the atmosphere to create the equivalent of a nuclear winter through volcanic activity or something. Well, I hope we never have a nuclear war to create that. But you could imagine scenarios where
Krakatoa comes to mind, where the 1800s.
Yep. So that kind of scenario. But that's relying upon something that's volcanic to do that. And that's not something that's going to happen from changes in the sun and so on. So at the moment, not in the near future. Very difficult to extrapolate much farther out. I mean, everything that we see right now, everything is on a warming trend, a very, very steep warming trend, geologically speaking, as well. So, I really don't know. I'd have to talk to a climate scientist other than those sort of like large amounts of aerosol in the atmosphere scenarios.
All right, 10:41, and David's on the line here this morning. Hi, David.
Hi, guys. Last week you sort of touched on the greenhouse effect, and I want to just sort of comment on that literally. I've been sort of doing a lot of work this winter doing heat and hot water experiments inside a greenhouse.
Okay.
So basically last Saturday, the outside temperature, I think it was about -2. So it was actually kind of a warm day. It was 53.8 degrees Celsius inside.
In the greenhouse.
Yep.
Inside the greenhouse. Yeah.
Yep.
And that's just literally, it's just because it's got, a large window area. It's well insulated, emits a lot of sunlight and, heats up to those extraordinary temperatures. So, pretty much the highest temperature I recorded inside there this winter was about 54.8. And that's sort of irrespective of the temperature outside. So it can be -2, it could be -12, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. So you have no internal heating process then?
No, basically, like it's the Bloomfield greenhouse on Almond Street. And it's just a large sort of like, not even glass, just sort of like plastic sort of material, special design for greenhouses, but, very inexpensive. And it's just a simple construction, well insulated. And basically anytime the sun pops out, the temperature inside just shoots up to these astronomical temperatures. So 54.8. I could literally like poach fish.
It's toasty.
I could poach fish, scramble eggs, make hollandaise if it was about another 4.2 degrees. But here's the thing too, because Well, I was sort of fixing up this greenhouse this winter. It's in an old parking lot that's no longer used, so it's black asphalt, but it's never salted or anything. It was one day, it was -9 outside. There was a strong wind blowing, so a significant wind chill. And just from the sun hitting the black asphalt was enough to melt all of that ice. So I was literally splashing around in the parking lot in the water and stuff while it was -9 outside. And because I was working outside, but in front of that big sort of like glass plastic surface or whatever it was, I was actually just in my, you know, my sweater, and I didn't have gloves on or anything. And I wasn't even cold just because of all that energy. So it's just like, it's just this incredible amount of energy that hits the earth any day. So basically what I've been doing is, instead of having your heat pump outside where it's -12 Celsius, you put it inside a structure like that where it's 50 Celsius. And basically for the same amount of electricity, you can get about 10 times the amount of heat or something like that.
Yeah. It's passive solar all over. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right.
And that's just one last thing, but I mean, that's sort of why all of the older homes around Halifax all had sunrooms in the front, because, you know, instead of having the south-facing exterior of your wall being outside where, you know, in the winter it could be -12 Celsius, it's backing against a sunroom where, you know, inside it'll be anywhere from 30 to 50 degrees Celsius. So I think they say, like, you know, a sunroom alone just passive solar will reduce your heating bill by about 40 or 50% or something that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good advice, Dave.
It's a big part of modern home design as well.
So everybody move into a greenhouse, right?
Yeah, and that segues into something we can do after the break as well on Greenland.
Sure. All right, we'll talk about Greenland in a moment. And again, if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Back with more right after this. Into the home stretch now with Dr. Rob Thacker and the Science Files here on this Monday morning. What's that?
I'm still alive.
You're still alive. He's hanging in here. It's just barely, but he's hanging in. You're a trooper here this morning, Dr. Rob. Appreciate that. You wanted to raise something about Greenland. What's going on?
This is something that I think with all of the rain today, people will actually appreciate very, very quickly. And so we talk about melt in Greenland. Greenland. How sick am I? Greenland. Melt in Greenland because of the impact it could have on the circulation of the oceans. And so what we're finding is that Greenland melt seems to be quicker than we would naturally expect. And so one of the factors in that that people are now starting to talk about is rain. And so we don't tend to think of rain being an issue in Greenland in the winter because you think it's going to be snowing all the time, right? So they've done a study which has shown typically, I think it's something like 15 years ago, they had maybe one or two rain events. Now they're getting several more rain events. And the real issue here is rain significantly changes how much energy gets absorbed onto the ice when the sun comes out on it. And so it gets darker. And everyone knows, we just had that conversation about asphalt and how something that's black absorbs heat better than something that's white that reflects heat.
Yeah.
So same thing with ice cover. If you have dirty ice cover, it absorbs energy and melts much more quickly than if it's pristine. And so if you have rain that naturally sort of like softens off the surface and makes it go dull, then it's actually going to end up melting quicker in the sun as well.
Hmm.
So this is something that's recently been studied in great detail. We've known about this for some time, but there was a big press release about this today. And this is a significant issue, maybe playing or one of the big factors in why Greenland ice sheet is melting faster than we thought it was.
Well, and the Antarctic ice cap is melting quickly as well, is it not?
Oh, yes, it absolutely is. I mean, one of the really sort of like disconcerting issues with trying to predict what's going to happen to these things is you don't know from year to year what kind of temperature you're going to have because of things like La Nina and El Nino and things like that. So you don't know what the global climate is going to do. And so predicting what's going to happen is quite difficult for the polar ice cap. But you can see this, I mean, what do they call it? They call it the spiral of death, that the amount of ice is going down over time on the particular way they graph it. And it's really quite disturbing. And so we're heading towards a situation with no ice at the polar cap in North Pole. So
saying the Arctic will be ice-free, they're saying in, 10, 20 years?
And so it's one of those things where, again, the faster it melts, it kind of just speeds up.
Yeah.
So it's quite disconcerting.
And, of course, that melt is also adding to a rise in the ocean waters, right? Or is it? No?
Well, so technically no, but what ends up happening is you actually wind up being able to move more of the water around. So it's everyone knows you put ice cubes in, and actually ice itself expands when it freezes.
I saw something the other day, and not connected with that, but it's a weather issue, and that is it snowed black snow in a town in Russia last week. And the question was, well, why is the snow black? It was pollution. It was a heavily industrialized city, and the pollution that was in the atmosphere mixed with the snow turned the snow, the white snow, black, and it fell to the ground as black snow.
That would be very disturbing.
That would be.
But secondary to that, I mean, that is exactly the kind of thing we were just talking about with the rain, but within snow.
Yeah.
So when you have dark snow, then anyone who's seen... go out, look at a sheet of ice sometime, and it's next to the side of the road. And you'll see where you have pieces of dirt just sitting on top of the ice. Over time, if the sun shines on that, those will just sink down into the ice, right? And you'll have little pock marks where the dirty stuff has gone down. The pristine stuff will still not have melted, but the dirty stuff will have gone down. So if you have black snow, right, that's going to land on top of all of the other snow, absorb the heat, melt all of that snow much, much quicker. And aside from just looking pretty horrible as well. So it does remind me of living in London in the UK. I lived there in London for a couple of years. And sorry, this is gross, but it's a science show, so I can do it. So my snot in my nose would be black sometimes because of the pollution.
Really?
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah, exactly. Yikes.
That's not good.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine. I mean, you look out here and you'll see, you know, it's not exactly pristine white, but you look out here and if it was black snow, that would be very concerning.
Yeah, well, you can see from our window, you can just see that whole thing I was talking about with the rain making the snow basically less white than it normally would be.
Yep. 10:52 is the time, and another question from a caller wondering, what caused the last ice age?
So I'm pretty sure, so the last ice age finished, well, about 12,000 years ago. So that is part of a global cycle that's relatively well understood called the Milankovitch cycle. And that's, if I remember this correctly, it's related to changes in the axial tilt of the Earth. Right. And then just over a period of time, we do that. We have the precession of the equinoxes as well because of that. And so that will change the overall amount of basically sun energy getting to different latitudes. And so it's kind of funny because it's not a particularly big change, comparatively speaking, but it will have a big change on the global climate over time.
But our poles are changing. Is that an indication of...
No, so you're talking about the flip of the magnetic poles?
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
That's actually quite different. This is related, well, you know, at the end of the day, technically because the magnetic pole is related to the internal movement of the interior core of the Earth, there could be changes in the moment of inertia of the Earth because of that, because it's the... I'm going off into science already, aren't I? So, but no, it's just basically the procession of how the Earth is changing its tilt slightly that does it. So right. It's probably not related to changes in the magnetic poles. I'm just going off on a very physics connection there.
Are ice ages cyclical things? I mean, is there going to be another ice age sometime down the road? Whether it's...
We would normally have expected that.
Yeah.
So the Milankovitch cycles are pretty well understood. These go back to the 1930s or 40s, I think. And so normally, yes, there would be this kind of cyclical ice age and so on. But now we have pushed our own climate so far in such a short period of time that it's not clear whether that kind of regular cycle would continue or not. Of course, the physics of what's happening and the change of the axial tilt, that will still happen. But the climate will be probably very different to what it was the last time that happened.
I guess we'll never know until...
Well, I'm not going to be around.
You're not going to be around. I'm not going to be around. So we won't worry about it.
These things take tens of thousands of years. I mean, that's the one thing where sunlight really kind of does have a significant impact on the climate. And again, that's more just because of the change of the Earth's axis tilt.
Before we go, ask you about this Goldilocks stars. And the headline, Goldilocks stars may be just right for finding habitable worlds. Hmm. It piqued my curiosity.
Yeah, no.
Says scientists looking for signs of life beyond our solar system face major challenges, one of which is that there are hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy alone to consider. To narrow the search, they must figure out what kinds of stars are most likely to host habitable planets. And a new study finds a particular class of stars called K-stars are perhaps the most promising targets for searching for signs of life.
Yeah, so stars come in all different shapes and sizes, from the very biggest stars to the very small stars. The really, really big ones are kind of a little bit like movie stars. They burn really hot and they burn up really quickly. So they aren't really good places for life, but then there aren't very many of them, so we don't care too much. You go all the way to the other end, and then you get red dwarf stars, which live for literally trillions of years. But they're kind of tempestuous in their early years, and they have lots of flares. And so we think that's really bad, because when you emit solar flares and so on, then, or stellar flares, I guess I should call them, it won't be from the sun. So you'll actually start putting a lot of radiation on the planet, and we think that would be obviously fairly bad for life. So you want a star that's kind of warm enough to be able to create life and not so unstable that it would be hostile to life. And okay. So K-stars seem to fit that particular mold, and there's a fair number of them, not as many as there are M-dwarfs or the red dwarfs, but there are more of those than there are stars like the sun. So we think that K-stars look really, really good in terms of where we could go and look for life. And so what this particular paper is focused on is looking at what they do to like molecules of oxygen and methane in the atmosphere. And they've shown that actually they don't destroy lots of methane in the atmosphere. So if we're really looking for oxygen and methane as signatures of life, we should be able to do that really well.
Well, again, it's, will we ever be able with our technology that you know of today, will like the Hubble Space Telescope or the James Webb that's going to be up there at some point down there, will be able to ever see any of these distant planets?
Well, so to take a sort of like pixelated image of a distant planet needs something that we currently call the Hyper Telescope. That's really difficult to do. We know what we'd have to build, but we're not likely to do that within my lifetime,
really?
To be honest.
Okay.
But we know what has to be done for that. But to actually find planets that are good candidates for life and have these what we call biosignatures, signatures of life on them, then, yeah, I think that's going to happen in my lifetime, because we're literally building telescopes that can do that right now.
Fascinating. Yeah. Dr. Rob, listen, I know you're not feeling well, and I appreciate you dropping by here this morning for Science Files, and you're a trooper here, so thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'm going back to bed.
Yeah, indeed. Well, it's where you should be. Dr. Rob Thacker in Science Files with us here on a Monday morning. Thanks again, Dr. Rob. It is now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off this morning. Manic Monday's coming up next hour. It's our first open hour of the week, and of course, in our open hours, anything goes. So our phone lines await your calls now, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with your calls after the news, and it is coming up next.